Hey there, welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that growing up, I lived in four different cities around Australia because my mother had itchy feet. Thank goodness she loved packing things up. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 27 of Making Positive Psychology Work. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Monica Wallin, an organizational psychologist, scholar, speaker, and writer, and the founder and CEO of Enliven Work, an innovation organization that teaches businesses how to tap into courageous thinking, compassionate leadership, and the curiosity to bring their best work to life. She's a research scientist at Stanford University's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, and Executive Director of Compassion Lab, the world's leading research collaboratory focused on compassion at work. But what you probably don't know about Monica is that she grew up in a small rural town called Elko, Nevada. Welcome, Monica.
Thank you, Michelle. I love that what we don't know about you is that you moved around a lot. And what we didn't know about me is that I stayed in one place my whole time.
Exactly. It's the little details of life that help us get to understand each other more, I think. Now, Monica, you have this wonderful new book coming out with the fabulous Professor Jane Dutton at the University of Michigan on compassion in workplaces. And so I'd love for you to talk to us today about what you've been finding in the book. People can pre-order it already on Amazon, but maybe let's start with the basics, because one of the things I often find when I go to talk about compassion in organizations is that there's a bit of confusion between the difference of, well, what is compassion and how is it different from empathy? So can we start there?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I love talking with people about how social scientists and positive psychologists define compassion because it really is complex. And when you see the way that we define compassion, I think it really helps you understand the difference from empathy. So when we research compassion, we talk about it as a four-part human experience that unfolds in relation to suffering. And the first part is that we have to notice that suffering is present in our lives and in the organizations around us. The second part is that we have to interpret that suffering in a way that makes us more likely to feel empathy and concern for what's happening. The third part is actually a form of empathy, which we call empathic concern. And that feeling leads us to taking action, to do something about suffering. So overall, compassion is defined as a process that leads us to notice and alleviate the suffering of others around us. And we've mapped out four parts of that process.
I think that's really helpful to break it apart in that way. And of course, you can see that the suffering happens in many of our workplaces, individually and collectively, with all the challenges going on each day around us. But why might companies invest particularly in teaching their people or, you know, building compassionate practices into our workplaces? My experience is that lots of CEOs, when I talk to them about compassionate practices, the first response is, well, you know, that sounds a bit soft given all the commercial realities that we're facing. How do you deal with that kind of feedback?
Yeah, that's so common that leaders feel like compassion is too soft to be really relevant to their bottom line performance. But we have over 20 years of research on the topic of compassion and organizations now. And there are many ways that we see in different bodies of research, our own and other people's, that compassion really impacts costly things in organizations. For instance, there's a very high correlation between whether people think they work in a compassionate organization and how much they are committed to stay in that organization. So we all know that turnover is very expensive, and retaining talented people is one of the highest priorities on many strategic agendas these days. So one way that compassion is really helpful to performance in an organization is through retention and commitment of employees. Another way along those lines that compassion matters to the bottom line of an organization is that compassionate environments really increase employee engagement. And all of the Gallup organization work teaches us that employee engagement also heightens customer engagement. So when we have more engaged employees interacting with clients and customers, they do higher quality service. They relate better with their customers or their clients. They keep them building loyalty to your brand. A third way that we know that compassion really affects the bottom line performance of an organization is through its resilience. So compassion in an organization helps people be adaptable to change. And some performance research in the financial services industry shows that when organizations are more compassionate, they're also more likely to bounce back faster after a downturn.
I think that's fascinating because many organizations, of course, particularly in the current environment, are looking for resilience training. But how often perhaps do we factor compassion as one of those skills we might teach workplaces for resilience training is certainly something I'm going to be thinking about for some of my clients later today as you bring that up. So the good news is I know if I've got a client that says, yeah, okay, let's invest in some compassion training, that you have built into the book a really beautiful personal blueprint that people can use in workplaces to improve their levels of compassion. Can you talk us through what the personal blueprint recommends for people?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we wrote the book with two kinds of people in mind. One is, as you say, the personal blueprint, where anyone at any level of an organization in any kind of role can ask themselves, what could I do to make my work environment more compassionate? And that blueprint has four parts that map on really well to that four-part definition of compassion that we talked about earlier. So the first thing that people can do to make their own work environments more compassionate is they can simply open their eyes more and make themselves more available to notice the suffering that's going on around them. When people remember a mantra that Jane and I always use and we always teach, which is there's always pain in the room, compassion goes up in your work environment automatically as a function of noticing more of the difficulties and the painful events that people are going through. The second part of the blueprint of making your work life more compassionate is a practice that we call making more generous interpretations. And this one is hard, and I think it takes practice, and it's where a lot of our mindfulness and equanimity training can also come in, because what we know is that when people are suffering and upset, they can act that out in all kinds of ways. Maybe they're late for work, maybe they miss some deadlines, maybe they make more mistakes than usual. Things like that happen when people are suffering. And we can interpret those things with generosity or with a lot of judgment. And I'm not saying that you should let everybody off the hook for everything, and it's fine if everybody's late all the time. But I am saying that it's worth asking yourself, am I interpreting generously what's going on here? Do I need to just find out a little bit more information? Is there some thing going on in that person's life that I might not know about that would help me understand and accommodate better? And that's a really powerful way of increasing compassion in your work environment. Another way is to tap into the empathy aspect of compassion and to bolster your feeling of concern. So one way that we can do this really easily is by listening to our own self-talk. We know from research into empathy that empathy is really sensitive to costs. And a lot of positive psychology researchers are showing us how fragile empathy is. So if you think to yourself, when you see somebody else in need, oh my gosh, I just can't handle that right now, or I don't have the resources to deal with this right now, that very act of talking to yourself about how you don't have the resources to respond is a compassion killer. So if you can actually activate your sense of, wow, I feel really concerned for what's going on. I wonder if I could just do something small. Then the fourth way that people increase compassion around them is by finding ways to act. And it's really common that people tell us that they want to be compassionate, but they don't know what to do. So we try to coach people and help people see that it's very often just a kind word, like, I'm really sorry for what you're going through, or a simple card, maybe, or an acknowledgement of suffering, or maybe it's just a question such as, is there any task that I could take off your plate today that would give you some flexibility? Things like that, which don't necessarily take a lot of your time and energy. They're small actions or gestures toward a person who's suffering can make a huge difference in helping that person actually feel like their suffering is acknowledged. And even if there's nothing you can, you know, nothing heroic that you can do to fix what they're going through, the acknowledgement of it and the expression of concern changes the work environment.
I completely agree. And I think one of the aha moments I have with many of the leaders I work with is just helping them understand that actually we all share that same deep psychological need to feel respected, to feel valued, and to feel appreciated. And I think, you know, the way that you're talking about those steps, again, gives us a really practical path to be able to gift that to other people and the sense of safety that that brings for us, just to feel that, feel that we have been seen, to feel that we are connected and supported in some way rather than quite so isolated. I think we underestimate how powerful those small gestures can be. But I also know you looked at it, well, if you're going to awaken compassion across a whole organization, exactly how do you pull that off? So do you want to share some of the pathways that you found for whole organizations to play with as well?
Yes. Thank you for that great tee up, because we, Jane and I and others in the Compassion Lab, have been doing this research, as I mentioned, for quite a long time now. And our distinctive focus has actually been on the organizational side. So we learn so much from our friends in social psychology and positive psychology who research compassion at the personal and interpersonal level. And what we tend to look at distinctively is what happens in a system. And if you think about this, you can kind of imagine it, why it makes such a difference with a simple thought experiment. In our compassion lab, we had someone who had really terrible trauma happen in her personal life. And when it happened, she was appointed in two different units within the university. And in one unit, people learned about this and they started doing what we were just talking about, just acknowledging that it was happening, asking if there was any way that they could create some flexibility, giving her the possibility to just talk and feel heard and noticed. And in the other unit, although the people were just as kind there, they learned that this was happening in her life and then they never mentioned it again. So there was no noticing and very little compassion actually came out. And the difference across the two units got us thinking that you can create an organization with equally kind people, and how you set up the system can either bring out that compassion or damp it down. Mm-hmm. And so we have studied four or five parts of an organization that leaders and managers can work with to really draw out compassion. The first is networks. So that's what we mean by networks, is how people are connected together and how you use the communication connections between people and the advice connections between people to share news about suffering and to update people about others' well-being. If people get isolated and they aren't connected with one another and they can't learn about what's going on with one another, then it's very hard for compassion to spread. So the first part of a system that we look at is networks. The next part that we tend to look at, and this is very common nowadays when you think about organizational culture, is we look at the values, especially the values that are lived out in the organization. And especially important for compassion are the kinds of values that feed into our sense of shared humanity. So do we as a group or a team really value being in it together? Do we value collaboration? Do we value things like you were saying, Michelle, like justice and fairness and respect for one another? And if those values are woven into the way we live out our work life together, then it's a lot easier to be compassionate when suffering strikes.
Mm.
And the third part of an organization that we look at and that we help people see how to make changes in is role definition. So that might sound a little boring, like how do we define our roles? But in fact, you know a lot, and I'm sure your listeners know a lot about job crafting mm-hmm. and role making and how powerful that can be to change the meaning of our work. And if you look at your role and you help other people in the organization look at their role with an eye toward compassion, and you say, how could we make every role in this organization more responsible for creating a compassionate work environment? You don't have to be in HR. You can be in any place in the organization and expand your role to include compassion. Everybody from, you know, the receptionist or the first person that someone talks to can be such an important space for noticing if something's going wrong or if someone is in pain. And that can spread all the way through the whole role system of an organization. And then we talk to people about another thing that sometimes sounds boring, but it's really powerful, which are the routines of an organization.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of my personal favorites to talk with people about because it's a little bit unexpected. But routines are so cool when you're an organizational scholar because they're the way that people coordinate with each other to get something done. And what we know about routines is that once they're well established, they're stored as procedural memory, right? People don't have to think about them in order to do them, but they're also not mindless. Just because we don't have to think about them doesn't mean we do them mindlessly. They're actually quite susceptible to improvisation. So if people think that taking care of each other and being compassionate to each other is such an important part of getting work done that they incorporate it into their routines, you can change some things that look like small behavior and get really, really powerful system-wide effects.
Mm-hmm.
The final thing we talk a lot about is leadership. And you mentioned leaders and the importance of leaders valuing compassion. Leaders have a hard job because they're justifiably afraid that if they make a compassionate decision in one case, they might set a precedent that they can't live up to in the next case.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of fear of compassion that gets in the way for leaders. And we try to help leaders think about role modeling their sense of the kind of human being they want to be and the kind of ways they hope other people in their organization will treat each other. So we think that leaders as examples of compassion are really powerful in organizations.
I think these are such powerful change levers. And I would imagine thinking about other pieces of the positive psychology puzzle organizations might be trying to introduce, that in addition to compassion, you could actually fuse some other practices along the way through networks, culture, roles, routines, leadership as well. But you also in the book talk about the importance of stories. And this is one of my personal favorites for creating change around the kind of folklore we create in organizations. Can you just talk to us briefly about the power you've seen of stories, perhaps in building more compassionate workplaces as well?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite topics too. When we ask people to tell stories of compassion, actually how quickly they can come up with a story and how emotionally laden that story is a really big indicator to us of overall the level of compassion in their system. So what we know from research on witnessing compassion is that even if I'm not giving compassion or I'm not receiving it, but I'm around an organization where I see it happen around me or I hear stories of it, that affects my willingness to be compassionate myself and my belief that I work in a compassionate place. So the presence of stories and the power that stories carry around is such an important part of creating a compassionate work environment. And we have seen instances, we tell a rather long story in the book as an illustration of a compassionate system. And in that case, that story has been circulating around in the organization where we first researched it for over 12 years now. It's such a powerful story, and it's such a vivid example of an organization full of compassion that I think people just keep telling it and retelling it because it helps them learn and make sense of new episodes of suffering that they encounter, and it helps them figure out what's the right thing to do if we want to be compassionate here. What would a compassionate organization do in this case? Mm-hmm. And so I think compassion stories are incredible in that way. And I want to just note another thing so that I don't sound, you know, naive about this. I just worked with a group of physicians from a major hospital in a world capital, and we were talking about creating a more compassionate patient culture in their hospital, and I asked them to tell stories of compassion as a way of starting out, and they could all tell stories of compassion from them toward their patients or their patients toward them. And I said, okay, now tell some stories about compassion toward your colleagues. And in fact, not one of them could think of a story.
Wow.
Their organizational environment in that hospital is so toxic, and they're working under such resource constraints, and people are really turning very uncivil toward each other, and they could only think of stories of a lack of compassion when they were thinking about how to relate with their colleagues.
Wow.
So sometimes for the people out there that are practicing and bringing positive psychology to life in organizations, I think it's also really helpful to ask people to adopt that generous interpretation mindset and have some tenderness and tell the stories of when compassion was missing, because those stories are so prevalent in people's workplaces right now.
Well, I completely agree. And I think they're beautiful sort of two sides of the coin examples of when it's there, what does it look like, and when it's not. And of course, you know, those stories are so much more powerful than any of the facts or the data that we can provide, no matter how robust it is, because it comes with all that emotion telling. Monica, are there examples perhaps or cautions or caveats where you think as practitioners we should be cautious introducing compassion into workplaces, or where you've seen it perhaps not quite go to plan that we should be aware of?
Yes, I think that just as you mentioned in the beginning, Michelle, when you said that you talk to leaders about a word like compassion and they say, oh, that sounds so soft, why would it matter? We can fall prey to the same thing as practitioners and researchers. We see the beautiful sides of compassion and the capacity that it offers for healing and resilience, and we get really taken in by that. But in fact, in workplaces, compassion is not always soft, and it's often not easy. And especially for leaders and managers, as I mentioned, there's a lot of fears around compassion, and there are a lot of dilemmas, because being a really compassionate manager or leader often puts you into a place where you're working with a person that's in tremendous pain, or a group that's in tremendous pain, and you have to simultaneously say, I understand and hear that you are hurting, and I absolutely have to insist on this standard of behavior or this standard of service or this kind of outcome in this organization. And as I said, when people are suffering at work and they're not comfortable revealing it, maybe they want to remain private or they're worried that something about their suffering will be stigmatized, mm-hmm. they may not be willing or able to reveal what's going on, but it may show up in their work behavior in the form of errors or mistakes or misjudgments or inattention, missing deadlines, as I mentioned. And so those kinds of things in workplaces can be terribly damaging, even when we know they're coming from suffering. So we have to find ways to be very caring toward the people and simultaneously upholding the kinds of standards and accomplishments that we need to create in work organizations. And I think if we hold on to the idea that compassion dilemmas are not a problem, in fact, they're very normal. And if we can help managers and leaders, especially, and people working with colleagues who are really suffering, to share wisdom about how to handle those dilemmas, we may never actually fully be able to resolve them, but talking them through and building more skill around handling the dilemmas is really important. And, you know, that's very, very far from soft work.
I completely agree. I think it's some of the hardest work we ever have to do as leaders. Now, Monica, are you ready for the lightning round?
Oh, I am so ready. I'm excited.
So besides compassion, if we take compassion as a given, what's the next most useful positive psychology or positive organizational scholarship tool or learning that you've applied in your own life and why?
I think the one I'm going to choose for today is strength spotting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sounds very familiar to you.
Absolutely. One of my favorites.
I find that the capacity to talk with people right off the bat about something that you see in them that's a strength is such a powerful way to build a relationship. And it's such a powerful way to change the quality of your life for the better every interaction you have.
Completely agree. Now, Monica, what would you recommend as the must-read book for people wanting to bring out the best in themselves and others in workplaces and why? And again, let's assume that Awaking Compassion at Work, your new book coming out, is a given. What would be next on the reading list?
Well, I want to point people to a book that seems a little older now, but it's called Curious by Todd Kashtan. It's kind of a positive psychology classic, I think. And if you haven't read it, it is so helpful in showing you that you can actually build your curiosity. And as you build your curiosity, you introduce more meaning into your life, you become a higher performer at work, you build more positive relationships. And I just think curiosity in the workplace is really an important and underemphasized strength.
I think it's a wonderful book. I'd highly recommend it as well. And Monica, what are you reading right now and are you enjoying it?
I am reading, I'm actually rereading a book that I read first a long time ago. It's called Talk of Love by the sociologist Ann Swidler. And I'm really enjoying rereading it right now because in that book, she talks about a sociology of culture and she distinguishes between settled and unsettled times. And I'm really thinking a lot about what compassion and positive organizational scholarship has to offer in unsettled times.
I think that's a great question to be reflecting on. So I'm going to go and grab that book as well and have a read. And Monica, there was one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to implementing positive psychology or positive organizational scholarship practices in workplaces. What would it be?
I would remind people the mantra that I mentioned earlier, that there's always pain in the room. And I would just add that we human beings are so fragile. I mean, we're so strong, but we're also so fragile. And there's so much pain and overload and overwhelm in our lives right now that I think understanding that the quality of care in our work relationships and the importance of that care is an antidote to how much of that fragility is present. And as our political and global cultural climates become more and more full of contentiousness, I think that caring for each other and knowing that we're all in pain is such an important way to change every day at work.
I completely agree. Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. This was a pleasure. I wish we had another hour.
Well, we can come back and do more as the book keeps coming out. And thank you so much for listening. For more of Monica's wonderful work, please visit thecompassionlab.com or monicawerlein.com. And you can pre-order Awakening Compassion at Work, the book that Monica's co-authored with the wonderful Jane Dutton, now on Amazon. And as always, we'll be sure to put all these URLs in the show notes for you. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid for the notes from today's shows and more tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, be sure to head on over to michellemcquaid.com. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today and share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces, I would be so grateful. After all, as Harrison Ford wisely said, "May the force be with you" is charming, but it's not important. What's important is that you become the force for yourself and perhaps for other people as well. Until next time, take care.